The Rathbones Inspired Minds podcast series.
Hello and welcome to the Rathbones Inspired Minds podcast series. I'm Daniel Norcross. In each episode, acclaimed writers, scientists, and entrepreneurs reveal what inspires them. And today, I'm joined by two people. Firstly, a woman who, alongside such luminaries as Bill Gates, Gustave Eiffel, Olivia Newton-John, and Clint Eastwood, was elevated to the prestigious Order of the Rising Sun by the government of Japan for her work curating both the Japan Marmalade and World Marmalade Awards, and alongside her, her daughter, who continues her work to this day. Welcome to Inspired Minds, Jane and Bea Hazel McCosh.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, Jane, I ask my guests this at the beginning of every episode. It's Inspired Minds. It's called Inspired Minds for a reason. What is inspiration to you, Jane? What does it mean? How necessary is it? How often do you think you've experienced it?
Wow, big question. I think that probably for me, inspiration is about something that means I cannot put it down. I can't forget it. I can't stop thinking about it. And I know that it's right and I've got to do it. So the inspiration for Marmalade, for instance, probably stems back to when I was quite young, when we made very good marmalade with my mother. But it was more than that. It was inspired by the fact that marmalade has been a constant thread through my life. And when things are difficult, a good marmalade sandwich or a marmalade scone is a pretty good solution to quite a lot of things. And when we got to the point, and this is really a terrible time for Cumbria, when we had foot and mouth, there were terrible implications following that. People didn't come to Cumbria, the tourism business went down the tubes, and we needed to get people back to Cumbria. And marmalade seemed to be a good way of doing it. So as a reference point, I thought, well, why don't we start a competition? And everybody knows that actually, if you do a competition, it does appeal to certain people. We are competitive as human beings. And so it began with 60 people entering, bamboozled into doing it, because obviously marmalade is so precious, you really don't want to give it away, but they did. And they started this wonderful competition through that. And each year we said, well, maybe we should stop now. If it goes down, if there are less entries, we'll stop. And instead it carried on. So for me, the inspiration of marmalade has been something that has just been a sticky thread all the way through life. And I have to be true to it and I can't let it go.
Well, there's a lot in there and we are going to discuss a lot of the threads. We're going to pick up a lot of those threads over the course of the next half an hour or so. But B, I have to ask you, because you're now involved in this, is it the marmalade that's inspired you? You're an artist as well. I mean, there may be other inspirations in your life beyond, I mean, it's hard to imagine, but are there other inspiring things or is it the marmalade for you?
Yeah, no, definitely. I think inspiration, I thought about this a lot, is probably human connection. So the thing that I find totally fascinating is when you meet someone and you know that they would have this amazing link and connection with someone else. And I think that's true in life, not just marmalade. But for me, the marmalade awards are just all about community and the humanness of it. And that's the thing that really drew me in. But also this amazing worldwide network that Mum has built up from these old women in Hiroshima who all cook marmalade together. And there's a man in Australia who enters every year and he picks oranges from his backyard. And there's a woman who built up a business in the Czech Republic based on a single entry in the Homemade Awards, and she was voted Czech Businesswoman of the Year. And all of these people keep being connected to our community in Cumbria. And so I think that is extraordinary. And it's something that's so valuable and so wonderful about the awards.
Now, we're going to talk a fair bit about marmalade, and I'm very much looking forward to this because it's going to be an education for me. As every episode of Inspired Minds is, sometimes we find ourselves talking to nature writers or geneticists, and I want to dig into the history of marmalade, Jane. Can I start with that? Because I've done a little bit of research. My understanding is much sketchier, I'm sure, than yours, but the Romans were involved in marmalade. The Portuguese seemed to pick up the mantle in the Middle Ages. And then before you know it, it's a staple of every English breakfast. Can you give us a sort of potted history of marmalade?
A quick one. I've always believed, because Dalmain is up in the north of England and we're very close to Hadrian's Wall, I like the idea that the Romans were eating marmalade when they were stuck on Hadrian's Wall. It's a pretty bleak place, beautiful but bleak. And so to be eating marmalade would be a good idea. And I think if one takes the ingredients, and those would have been things like quince and honey and local delicious water from the stream, you've immediately got something absolutely wonderful, which is a marmalade. And so there they were eating their marmalade. And then you progress on and you look at banquets from Elizabeth the First's time, where they eat a very consolidated, cooked down version of oranges as a digestive at the end of a meal. Which is wonderful. Dundee marmalade, I think the Scots would say that they had invented marmalade, and I think they're good marketeers, but no, it appeared before then. And as you rightly said, in Victorian times, there were so many different companies producing different kinds of marmalade, which has actually been quite inspirational in the kind of marmalade we've put into our competition. So we have categories for eating marmalade with fur, fish and fowl, you know, as well as eating marmalade on toast. And so that was very much inspired by Victorians. And then as we went on and we started eating differently, marmalade took a bit of a dip. And I can remember when we first started our competition, the grocer used to come out with very sad figures for marmalade. They'd say less and less people are eating it, less and less people are buying it. So that might have been true, but what they weren't taking into account, of course, was the actual army of people, a huge army of people making their own marmalade. And that was the difference. And that's what we found that we tapped into, that actually people really care what they're eating. And so to buy marmalade is almost infradig. You've got to make your marmalade. You've got to make it with real fruit. And that's what we found, thousands and thousands of people.
Did the Marmalade Awards, do you think, save marmalade? I mean, because now, I mean, I do see marmalade. I see marmalade a lot. I mean, it might be the sort of places I go to. I've got quite a few artisanal bakers and the like. And you know, you go into your local Spanish deli, there's marmalade. What was sort of taking over? Were people buying fancily produced jams instead, Jane? Is that what was going on?
I think so. I also think that marmalade has morphed into something pretty cool, and it perhaps had lost its original standing as marmalade that you have with toast, and that's very nice, and you eat breakfast and everything else. But now marmalade is used for so many different dishes and meals, and when you hear chefs talking about using a marmalade glaze with a certain kind of fish, and you know, it's incredibly imaginative. And so perhaps where marmalade had got to, it had gone into a cul-de-sac and it needed to come out and be almost reinvented. But the glory of it and its strength, undoubtedly, is its history, that it goes right back into our roots, and it absolutely triggers something in people that is quite different from perhaps a modern food. It's got this cultural heritage.
Now, B, we need to start at first principles. What is marmalade? I ask that. It sounds like an absolutely ridiculous question. But having spoken to a few people about marmalade, I discovered that there are so many different types of marmalade. So let's get to the very first principle. What defines a marmalade over any other preserve, a conserve, a jam, if you will?
So a marmalade is primarily made of citrus fruit, but it just has to be the overarching ingredient is a citrus fruit. But what we found over the years, and particularly the judging, you become incredibly judgmental of something if it's something that, you know, is a Seville marmalade, but it's just the peel's not quite cooked, or it's not filled to the top, or the set's not quite right. So there's things that make a good marmalade and there's things that make an excellent marmalade. But I would say probably the excellent ones are interesting citrus fruit or very fresh citrus fruit, but it can be anything. So we had over the years, we've had like extraordinary entries. So we had a squid ink marmalade. So primarily we're using citrus as a base, but then they put squid ink and it had this amazing taste of almost quite savoury taste. Obviously, all of the countries where citrus grows, like Japan and Australia, and their citrus fruit is incredibly fresh and they have such a huge variety. So we've seen a real uptick in like yuzu entries, for instance, or wonderful different citrus fruits. but you can put anything in. We get entries every year from an artisan maker in Hawaii, and he sends us pineapple marmalade, and that's absolutely delicious.
So marmalade does not have to be oranges. I reckon that if you ask sort of 80-90% of, maybe it's urban dwellers particularly, but if I ask somebody in London, you know, describe marmalade for me, they would say it's oranges, usually Seville oranges, in a thick jelly. I guess that's pectin somewhere getting involved there. And then it's really about, do you want it to be thick cut or thin cut? That's the basic starting point when you ask, I would have thought, people about marmalade. Whereas you're telling me that pineapple marmalade, that's distinct from pineapple jam. How is that distinct from pineapple jam?
Because pineapple mixed in with citrus fruit just makes this absolutely, I mean, pineapple itself is a citrus. Mum, is that correct?
I don't think it is, no. But if the pineapple is added
to a base of citrus.
Exactly. And so the absolute dominant taste has to be citrus. So the pineapple then adds, as I remember it, it was a wonderful texture.
Going back to popularization of marmalade, Paddington, I think, has really added to the popularization of marmalade, and people understand more what it is. And with the release of all of the films, our website traffic for the Marmalade Awards has gone up massively in the last like 2 months, specifically, I think, because people have been Googling marmalade.
It's a celebrity endorsement. And presumably when the Queen took a marmalade sandwich out of that bag, you would imagine you would see marmalade sales go through the roof.
Yeah, and when the Queen died, sales of marmalade went through the roof. It was such a link because of that sketch.
It was a wonderful sketch. And when we first started the competition, I got in touch with Michael Bond and his daughter, Karen Jankel, and asked them whether they would, as indeed Paddington is, a patron of the Marmalade Festival. Well, Paddington had never been asked to be a patron of anything before, so that was very good indeed. But they had that terrible scandal when Michael Bond talked about Marmite and marmalade, if you remember. And we had a marketing company who said, we gather that Paddington's going to be at your festival, and we'd like to send some commandos to parachute down and protect Paddington from the Marmite insurgents.
So I have to confess that I have an older brother who has appalling taste, and he routinely, as a child, used to put Marmite and marmalade on the same piece of toast. He also did the same thing with honey.
I've heard that before, Marmite and marmalade combo.
And we actually had an artisan who actually made it as a marmalade combination. She won a gold for it, and it was an extraordinary combination, but really clever, very subtle.
We need to go back again, I'm afraid, because I know about the Marmalade Awards and you have mentioned them. I'm going to start with you, Jane, because you did in your intro mention a couple of things there about how Foot and Mouth had been a scourge of your community. Why did you alight on marmalade as the way to bring people together and to develop tourism? And so it tried to take us back to 2005, you know, how bad it was then. I want to talk here a little bit about the recipes that you've got hidden in your attic. So just take us right back to that starting point, please.
I think it's very interesting. And with Foot and Mouth, we found that people weren't visiting Cumbria and small companies were going bust. And I had a great friend who was a marmalade and jam producer, and she was very much on the edge of losing her business. And it seemed to me that, and probably she was one of the influences, that we needed to get people back to Cumbria. But we worked very slowly, so this didn't happen immediately after Foot and Mouth. It took a few years to think it through. But I also feel very, very strongly about, if you're going to do something, you've got to do it well. You've got to try your very hardest. And so as a child, you know, when we made things such as marmalade, we had to do our very best. It might turn out to be rubbish, but you had to do your best. And so it seemed to me that it would be quite fun to have a competition. It seems to me that it would be worth doing something where you could do your best, and things like chutney or jam or marmalade. And because I love marmalade in all its forms, so marmalade with sausages is good, marmalade with croissants is good, marmalade in a drink, you know, a cocktail is good. There are so many varieties, and maybe that's its charm, and that's why I was so fascinated by it, that it has this extraordinary depth. You can go off-piste in many different directions with marmalade and still find you're talking about marmalade. So it's exciting. So it's always exciting. For the last 20 years, it has been different every single year, new ideas have come in, new kinds of marmalade, new thoughts. So I think that's how it survived. But going back to the beginning, it was because I think we wanted to do something with our community where we'd get people coming and staying in hotels and bed and breakfasts, using taxis, and come to a festival. And I felt also that I wanted to do something which would raise money for charity. And we've raised over 300,000 for the local hospice. But on top of that, hospices now all over the world benefit from the marmalade entries, because the money goes to hospice work all over the world. I wanted to do something for education. I wanted people to understand what is marmalade. It's what you've asked, you know, what is it? And the variety of incredible citrus which we have discovered. And finally, probably, I wanted the standard of homemade marmalade and artisan marmalade to be of the very tip-toppest that we could possibly get, because we should be proud of it, because it's our heritage.
Now, Bea, you've become very heavily involved in the awards in the last couple of years. I imagine you were growing up with these awards as well. Can you give us a sort of insight into what did your house look like in the lead up to the Marmalade Awards? As you walk down to breakfast, how many different varieties are you now looking at and thinking, did you ever get sick of it?
Definitely don't get sick of it. But someone wrote an article about the awards a couple of years ago, and she started off by saying Dalmain is full of half-eaten jars of marmalade, which I think is incredibly true. So we have about 3,000 entries from all over the world every year, and people come and collect them. But we are left with about 1,000 at the end of each year, and we give them away to communities. But yeah, we do get left with a lot. So we have so much after the festival around the house. But during the first 4 months of the year, so when the jars start arriving at the start of January, we have bread trays and bread trays and bread trays just full of jars and jars and jars, all kind of being organized and in the process of being logged and unwrapped. We have a room of unwrapping. So we have a load of deliverers from all over the country coming. We have the same guys who come, you know, every single day for the whole of January. So you get to know the postman very well. Once they've been logged, they get put in bread trays ready to be laid out around the house for the festival. So yeah, we live in sort of marmalade chaos for a couple of months.
Okay. And these are just questions that just keep occurring to me. So bear with me. I've now got in my mind, I think I saw 3,000 entries or something might have been mentioned one year.
Yeah.
I don't know. How do you give 3,000 different marmalades enough thought? I presage this by saying that I'm on the judging panel for something called the MCC Cricket Book of the Year Award, and I get about between 40 and 50 books. I'll be honest with you. I can read 20 of them and know within 50 pages that this isn't getting shortlisted.
Oh, totally. It's the same with marmalade. I think you know immediately if it's gold. And also, it's this unknowable factor. Even if someone has only judged once or twice before, every single person in the room will be like, yep, this is gold. And as soon as we have a gold, the whole room gets excited and everyone tastes it. So we have the judging over a period of about 3 weeks.
How many judges?
Maybe about 60 judges total. We've got lots of local judges who come in. They've been judging for years and years and years. And then chefs and journalists and food writers. And finally, it gets whittled down to kind of five from each category. And the team from Fortnum's comes up and chooses the winner.
There's a magic, though, to each jar. If you imagine, you pick it up and you look at it and you unscrew its lid. And this could be the winner. This could be the best in the world, as we like to think it will be. And so to do that, it's hugely exciting. I still find it exciting. With every single jar, I think this could be it.
You definitely become very attached to your horse, don't you? You know, when you've judged something and you're like, this is a gold, all the golds go onto one table and then everyone retests them again to make sure they're golds. And then everyone sort of has their thoughts and you become like, this was the one that I gave gold and I really think that should be the winner.
It must be very subjective, but you've also said you've got lots of different categories. So are those categories broken down by type of fruit, or is it, you know, a spicy one, a clear one, a thick cut one, a thin cut one? And then ultimately you end up like you do in Crufts with best in show. Because obviously, you know, you've got all the, I don't know, the best Labradors and the best pugs and what have you. And then finally some completely bizarre dog ends up winning the best in show. So is that sort of how you do it? Talk me through the pyramid.
Definitely. It's hard to judge all of the marmalades against each other, but I think, Mum, you'll agree, you can tell a really good one. So people often say, oh, but what happens if you don't like lime marmalade or something? So I think objectively, you can still say this is a really good marmalade. The set's good. All of the judging criteria means it's very easy to say this is checking all the boxes. And often lime isn't quite their thing. They'll pass it to another judge who does like lime. So it's not like it's being negatively judged. It's not like we're looking for mistakes. It's a very positive system. And often people do just fall down because their peel isn't quite cooked. Or it's a lavender and yuzu marmalade and you can't taste the lavender. So it's sort of the balance of ingredients.
And that's an interesting thing. You know, what do you choose? So some people pile in so many ingredients, so many spices, and you think too complex, too difficult, too muddled, and keep simple. Or they put in vodka, which you really can't, it doesn't make any difference to the marmalade if you put vodka in.
Or Earl Grey, which is orange-based. It's an orange-based tea, so it's very hard to taste.
And yet, I think the ingenuity of homemade makers is astonishing and sometimes is way ahead of the game in terms of artisan versus homemade. People have practiced and practiced. The last winner we had, he has been entering, for 8 or 9 years? And his marmalades, both with most unusual ingredients, but incredibly well balanced, are just amazing. So good that it was the first time ever that we couldn't judge one winner. So he actually had won two of his categories. And so actually we had to produce them both, a double gold for both marmalades. One of the lovely things when we get all these parcels coming in, and I remember in the old days when we first started, the doorbell would ring and we'd cry, we'd shout, marmalade. I don't know whether you remember that, Beatrice, when you were 20 years ago. That was a sort of, oh my goodness, this is really exciting, another jar. But you unwrap them and each one of those parcels has a personality. It's the jar. It has its own personality. Often people send letters. There was one letter I got which said it enclosed an extra tenner. And it said, the person said, I've never won, so I thought I'd resort to bribery.
Well, why not? Whatever works for you. Now, I'm imagining when it first began in 2005 that it was, I'm going to say, use the word parochial. I mean, probably local, quite local, it would have, I imagine. But one of the striking things is how this has become international. And it has resulted, Jane, in you winning the Order of the Rising Sun, which is magnificent. Please explain what I'm talking about.
It is. It's an incredible honour. And it came about because we had very much noticed that Japanese people were entering our competition and more entries were arriving and they were beautiful and many of them were very good and over the years have got better and better. And so I approached the embassy and the ambassador, who was then Ambassador Surioka, and said, would they ever consider having a marmalade festival in Japan? And I was terribly lucky because the particular ambassador who was living in London at that time was very open to the idea. And so every time he had a mayor or somebody important came to visit him from Japan, he'd say, now, would you be interested in having a marmalade festival? And eventually we found this amazing mayor Ashiro. And he said, yes, let's have a go. And he has all the eccentricity and all the sort of good ideas that go with this kind of thing. So, for instance, he paints all his post boxes orange. And there are great big posters and videos of our marmalade festival all around the town. And he has wonderful, incredible chefs from Tokyo come down to Yawatohama. And they demonstrate cooking with fish, which is their number one thing. They've done in the Ehime prefecture, which is right down in the south of Shikoku. And so it's a long way from Tokyo. So they've been busily applying all their ingenuity and exciting ideas to their festival. And so they then felt that they'd like to recognise what we had done. But I do feel that this award is absolutely wonderful, but I don't really deserve it on my own because this is such a team effort, this Marmalade Festival. But I have accepted on everybody's behalf and it is absolutely beautiful.
I mean, is this entirely new to Japan? Because obviously, speaking as a sports commentator, it's always slightly concerning when a country takes up, in my case, cricket, and within 10 or 15 years is beating the English at it. And you sort of think, how? Why have we been doing it all wrong? Are the Japanese coming to take all the awards? Did they not have a standing start? Did they perhaps have a tradition in a different form of preserve that they were making, but it just wasn't necessarily categorized as marmalade?
Well, I think it's interesting because when they first sent their marmalades, a lot of them were quite liquid and didn't seem to have set, and that was a problem. And we discovered that often that was because they were throwing away the first boiling water and then reboiling it to make their marmalade, which is fine. But actually, you throw away all your pectin, and so you've lost your setting power. And so because this competition is a British-style marmalade, because, in fact, America equally well have quite a tradition, wouldn't you agree, Beatrice, with sort of slightly loose...
runny marmalade, yeah. There's an artisan in New York who enters every year, and her marmalade is unbelievable, but it's very runny.
Yes, one of the things she put in was horseradish in one of her marmalades. Gosh, it was good. It's so subtle and so clever, but it was very runny. I mean, it should have got gold out of gold, but it was just not set enough because it wasn't British style.
Now, before we came on, just continuing the theme of internationalism, you did a very short throwaway line about the marmalade ashes. Now, this is going to trigger a man like me for all sorts of very obvious reasons, as you can imagine. I've sat and commentated on many games of cricket in which the Australians have beaten England. Don't tell me that they are winning the marmalade ashes as well. Is this true?
They are absolutely trashing us.
On toast? Are they doing us on toast?
So no, it's not on toast. It's by a small spoon, and we have three English judges and three Australian judges. So last year we had the Australian Deputy High Commissioner, Elizabeth Bowes, came up to the festival, and she was one of our Australian judges. And Dan Leppard, who's a patron, and Jane Harley, who's one of the architects of the Australian Festival of Marmalade. And they were our three Australian judges last year. But yeah, I think Australia wins 8 out of 10 times, I'd say.
The glorious thing is that there is such a thing as the marmalashes in a small courtroom in Buninyong, and it's locked away in a safe there. And I think it's a wooden spoon, I suspect, in ash form. which we are told will never come to England, and it will always stay in Australia.
I think that's revenge for the fact that the cricket ashes, the original ashes, remain in the Lord's Museum. And
I think
never
that's
allowed
true.
They were always going to get their own back somehow. B, I want to address this to you because we're running out of time, but you mentioned early on as one of your inspirations about people and about community. And what I'm hearing loud and clear is that this whole initiative, not escapade, this initiative that began back in 2005 out of almost necessity in a way, has now become international. It's opened you up to a very wide community. Has that been part of what really draws you back into it year after year?
Yeah, I think so. And obviously the kind of charitable aspirations that go with that are enabled hugely as well. And I should say that we're only able to give such a big amount to charity is because of the sponsors. So Rathbones, Fortnum & Mason, Westman & Family. So they have T-Bay and Gloucester services and Lycett's. And so it's kind of with their help that we're able to do all of this, really. Also their enthusiasm. So Sarah Dunning from Westman & Family was really helpful and supportive when I had an idea to create a category last year for prisons and people within the justice system. And yeah, she put me in touch with lots of people. And yeah, we got 20 entries, which is great. And so it's kind of tapping into these different groups of people, the ability to come together through cooking and that to be an inspirational thing, particularly within prisons. It's important to have skills that you might transfer into like a self-starting job. So I went to visit a prison in Cumbria to talk about it with an artisan producer and talk about the possibility of marmalade. And I think that's something that I find incredibly inspiring, is that it's not just a small festival in Cumbria and we don't have lots of numbers who come to the actual festival, but it's this thing that has little branches of possibility.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I think we're quite clear that we're not parochial. You know, that actually hospice at home, hospice as a charity, is an international thing, and that the people involved are on a wider scale. So the Worshipful Company of Fruiterers, and one of the patrons is the rector from Mary-le-Bow, St. Mary-le-Bow, because of the Great Bell of Bow in the nursery rhyme. And so it's looking much wider than Cumbria.
But with these amazing volunteers and this amazing community of people who've just stuck with us, you know, like the person who logs all the jars came and did it the first year and she's done it for 20 years. And she's incredible that we just couldn't do it without her. People like that who add to the working parts of the whole.
I'm sort of hearing a story because we had Sarah Dunning on Inspired Minds very recently. And we're going to wrap up very shortly. That I want to get both of your takes on Cumbria, specifically the locality and the way you go about things. I live in London, I'm from London, and it's a relatively anonymous environment. There are little pockets of community, they spring up here and there. But what I've heard now in the last couple of podcasts I've done is about this particular community in Cumbria and how important it is for this community to work together to use, how can I put it, I suppose, independent artisans in the making of what they're doing and bringing that community together to enhance that whole. B, can I get yours and then Jane's take on what is so unique about this part of Britain?
I think it's just, it feels historically old. There's this ancientness of it. People have been farming and working the land for such a long time. And as a result, families have been working together for generations. So Delmaine, where we live, has been there for such a long time. And we've been involved in communities like the church and the rugby club and local groups and gardens groups and people who have this link or helped work in the tea room 20 years ago and they every so often come back and have a cup of tea with a friend. Or there's all of this human connection. I imagine it's the same in other counties, but I think Cumbria is particularly special because it has this like wildness and beauty and it's slightly remote. I don't know. I don't think that's a very good answer. I don't know how to say it, but I think it's just, yes, it's just such a special thing to be part of. And what I really like about having spent, you know, lived at home and been around is you get to know people and you get to know people's kids. And it's not the same as London at all. It's, you know, you get to know people because you see them all the time and drive past them and give them a wave. That's what I really like about being at home.
I think you're absolutely spot on. And I think that maybe it's an advantage. When we started this Marmalade Festival, I was told that no journalist in their right mind would ever come near Cumbria because it was too far away. And that a competition, a festival would not work like this because it was too far away from London. But maybe that's Cumbria's strength, that actually it's not as fluid as other communities. And so we, for instance, at the moment have an electrician working for us who is the grandson of the electrician who used to work for us at Delmaine, because I'm now quite old. And so we've got this lack of fluidity, maybe, and that communities still are very much the same, that there are farming families that go down through generations upon generations. And so although it is a long way away from busier and more thriving places, it is also its strength. And of course, the beauty of Cumbria is a very welding and beautiful. It's a wonderful thing to be in this incredible space.
People are much more reliant on each other in a way that maybe isn't true of being in a city.
Yes, and I think that the remoteness was something I think that gets you. There is nowhere to be remote in Tooting, I can assure you of that. I suppose what Tooting does have in common with Cumbria is that we are connected to the world. It's just perhaps not via the medium of marmalade. Jane and B, Hazel McCosh, it has been thoroughly fascinating to have this navigation through marmalade, something that I just take it for granted and whacked on a piece of toast or put in a croissant. But I've never actually cooked fish in it. That might be my next recipe.
You'll have to come and be a judge.
I would love to be a judge.
You're booked.
I might not be a very good judge, but I'm definitely up for it because free marmalade, I mean, who's going to turn that down? Thank you so much for being on Inspired Minds. It's been magnificent.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for having us.
You've been listening to the latest episode of the Rathbones Inspired Minds podcast series with me, Daniel Norcross, and my fabulous guests, Jane and B. Hazel McCosh. You can listen to previous episodes of the series on all major podcast platforms. And if you enjoyed listening, don't forget to like or subscribe. To find out more about the series, just go to rathbones.com.
The Rathbones Inspired Minds podcast series, now available on all podcast platforms and at rathbones.com.
If you've enjoyed Rathbones Inspired Minds, please do check out Rathbones Inspired Sounds, the podcast on which Rathbones investment managers talk to household name entrepreneurs on their business enterprises, their journeys, and the road to success. Available wherever you get your podcasts.